Artist and educator Al Bright was born in Youngstown, Ohio on January 9, 1940, and died in Columbus, Ohio on October 28, 2019. Thanks to Isabel Wilkerson's best-selling book, Cast, Ava DuVernay's film adaptation, Origin, and his work currently featured in Greatness Revealed at the Butler Institute of American Art in Youngstown, Al Bright's story and work has reached an international audience. Depicted in the book and movie is a gut-wrenching racist event Al experienced as a little boy. It may have at the time passed for status quo, but in retrospect, it has bristled the country's collective conscience. To better know him and share his inspiring story, I sat down with Al's former wife, Dr. Dee Banks, his daughters, Leslie and Nicole, former TV executive, current Butler board member, and fine art print publisher Larry W. Jones, and last but not least, his lifelong best friend, author Mel Watkins. It is with immense honor and pride I let you know Al Bright was from Ohio. All right, so I started in Youngstown with Dr. Dee Banks, and I asked her about the scene from the book and the movie.
So the story is a little 8-year-old Albright was a catcher on a baseball team, and the team won the championship. And so as a reward, the coach said, well, we're going to all go swimming at the local pool. So Al said he was really excited to go, and, you know, Al couldn't swim, but he was just excited to go and splash around in the pool with the other boys. So when he got to the pool, the owner or manager or whatever of the pool comes to the gate and says, well, you all can come in, but he can't, pointing to Al. And he said, so the coach said, you know, what's the problem? He goes, well, he just can't come in here. So the coach said, you know, we just won the championship. I mean, is there anything that you can do? Paraphrasing this because I, you know, Al told this story so many times. And he said, all right, there's one thing that we can do. We'll put him in a dinghy by himself and we'll pull him around the swimming pool in the dinghy. But he cannot put his hands in the water.
Oh, my goodness.
Because if he puts his hands in the water, we'll have to drain the pool. So Al says, you know, he remembered he was in the dinghy, and he just remembered looking at all those people's eyes around the pool. No one came to his defense, not the coach. You know, the coach might have said, well, you know, if he's not going to come here, we're going to take the whole team away. That never happened. And the sad thing, too, is that his mom wasn't there. She was working. So he really didn't have anybody to comfort him after this. And this event, I mean, really was a significant, had a significant impact on his life. You know, he told him you couldn't be in Al's presence more than 2 or 3 hours when he didn't tell this story. And I guess it just sort of, you know, it didn't make, I don't think Al was bitter, but it just made him look at life differently. So that's a story.
And how did that story end up making it into the book?
So Isabel Wilkerson was doing her research. In the book, she describes finding this book by Mel Watkins, who's from Youngstown. Mel was All-American basketball player that he went to Southside with Al and was one of his oldest friends. And Mel Watkins wrote a book called Dances with Strangers about Youngstown. And in Dances with Strangers, he wrote this story. Isabel Wilkerson found it and incorporated it into her book.
A little later in our conversation, I asked Dee about how Al began painting to jazz music.
And I think one of the highlights of his career was when he, after he came to Youngstown State and was in the art department and so forth, that's when he evolved into painting to jazz music. Because painting to jazz music with abstract expressionism, with jazz being an abstract genre of music, It just kind of fit. And so he brought people to town like Art Blakey, the Jazz Messengers, with a very young 19-year-old Wynton Marcellus.
Tell us about the show that's happening at the Butler Institute of Art next month. Well, in February.
So one of my dreams was to go to Lou Zona, who is the executive director of the Butler, and pitch an idea And I'm on the board of trustees now, so I've thought, well, you know, I might have a little bit more of his ear.
A little sway.
My dream was to curate a show, and we're going to have about 35 to 37 works. The show is called Greatness Revealed, African-American Art from the Permanent Collection of the Butler Institute of American Art.
Okay.
Al never, in my opinion, never reached the heights that he should have reached as an artist. But he is now the subject of a movie that is called A Masterpiece. And, you know, he's gone from us now, but I think he's looking down someplace in heaven just saying, oh my God, you know, this is great. I mean, that's really how I sort of look at it. He's finally got, I guess,
the recognition he deserved.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Next, it was a drive down I-71 to Columbus for some kitchen table confidential with Al's daughters, Leslie and Nicole.
What did Youngstown mean to your dad?
Everything.
Why?
Because he was born and raised there. All of his, you know, life-shaping moments happened there, even the painful ones, the one that's illustrated in the book.
Right, Cast.
You know, yeah, in Cast. But that was where he was born and raised. He was educated there. And then, you know, he got his sea legs from his artistic standpoint in Youngstown.
Yeah. Tell me, if you grow up with the dad is a full-time artist, what's that like?
Well, dad was, we never saw a struggle.
Yeah.
Like, so nothing was a struggle for us. So we didn't see, nothing was perceived that way. Because he was an art professor at the university, and he did his art simultaneously.
And did you realize how special your dad's work was when you were growing up, or did it just seem like, that's just what my dad does?
I always thought it was special only because I watched him paint them. Mm. And Daddy's, before he got a studio, he painted in our basement and when we lived in Mill Creek Park.
Oh.
And so you go down there, and it was just...
It smelled like turpentine
and cigarettes. Yep.
Yeah.
And he would be at that dark corner, and he would be back there painting. We'd watch him paint. And so it was just something he did, and I always enjoyed watching him
paint.
You
know, tell me something. Did he, when he would paint, was he the type of artist that would be like, okay, you know what? It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I start at 10, and I'm done at 4.
No.
Or would he just be down there at like 3 in the morning when he had some?
Yeah.
He was very, very... eccentric and impulsive. And I think a lot of his artwork was more ethereal when he was creating. So whatever came to him is what he created.
Tell me the story of the shredded piece of art.
Well, so I believe he had a theft because he didn't know why that painting was there, but he was driving.
Wait, where did it get stolen from?
I don't know if it was in his studio.
I think it wasn't from his studio.
Yeah, something. The painting was missing. And
so the painting goes missing, and he knows it's missing now. He's like,
this is a long time.
Right, but he knows that the painting's gone.
Yeah.
Okay, now what?
The painting's gone.
All right.
And he was, my grandmother, his mom, lived on the south side by St. Elizabeth Hospital. He's going, you know, to her house. He's driving somewhere on the south side, and he drives past this old raggedy house and sees the painting hanging on a garage door, all torn up, and there's this big Doberman pincher or something in the driveway that had just been gnawing and scratching away at this painting.
It's not funny. And
yeah, so he went and got the painting. He took that painting.
He did?
Yeah, he did.
And
he
where is it now? Do you have the painting?
Have it. Mm-hmm.
You have it?
Yeah. It's off the canvas.
That might be one of the best pieces of art. Wow. Yeah.
If ever there's a display of that, I would love to have that bromosynthesis and bring like all those paintings back together and kind of do a call out on that.
Mm-hmm. Back to New York, where I caught up with former TV executive, current Butler board member, and fine art print publisher, Larry W. Jones.
All right. So tell me, how did you discover Al Bright and what drew you to his art?
A few years ago, a painting came up for auction at a gallery here in New York, and my friend who owns the gallery mentioned that this piece of art was coming up, and it was by an African-American artist, Al Bright, that I had never heard of before. So I went into the gallery and I looked at the piece and I loved it. It was really spectacular, I thought, and the size was incredible. And then I did a little bit of research in the week or two that I had before the auction actually happened. And I found out that he was from Youngstown, Ohio. And I was like, well, I think I will try to get that. And I was successful in purchasing that painting.
And then you subsequently met Al, right?
Yes, I met Al a couple of years after that, or within a year of that. I think a mutual friend introduced me to him, and then I went to his gallery, or his studio, I should say, where he was working. And he had so many paintings there, and then I realized that he had a very long career painting, and I was also a professor at Youngstown State. But had never really left the state of Ohio as far as him pursuing his career, which is probably why most people didn't really know about Al's work.
Now, there seems to be an uptick in African-American art and people collecting African-American art. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what your perception of that is and why it is?
Well, there's two different ways to look at it. There's the contemporary African-American art market, and then there's the historic African-American art market. But both markets are driven predominantly by the number one factor is art museums in the United States historically did not buy works by black artists.
Why?
So in most museums in the United States, there's very low representation of black artists in their collections. And the reason is because most of these museums were run by white Caucasian directors and curators, and they in many ways didn't even occur to them that there were black artists in America and in their communities that were making art. So it simply never entered their minds, and it never got onto their radars, and they never thought that African Americans could actually produce art in many ways. So the market just didn't exist for museums. Within the last 10 to 15 years, definitely over the last 10 years, every single museum in the United States has come to the realization that most of their collections are greatly lacking in representation of black artists. So there has been a feeding frenzy over the last 10 years to buy key pieces for their collections. And the market, it started with historic art, has been driven very much by that factor. And then that brought in a lot of more exposure for black artists. Mm. And then the collectors came along. And then the contemporary artists also started to get an uptick because the museum started to say, well, we don't want to miss today's trend-making black artists. So they started to collecting more contemporary art, and then that fueled collectors because they would now see an African-American artist in the museum. It spread the word, it spread their fame, and then it just fed the whole ecosystem. You know, I'm hopeful that over time, more people hear about Al Bright and the more people that see him in the various institutions that do collect him, the Cleveland Museum, the Akron Museum, the Butler Museum of American Art in Youngstown, all have pieces by Al. But the goal really is to get his fame above and beyond Ohio to get the recognition that he truly deserves.
And following a screening of Origin, I sat down on an East Village brownstone stoop and spoke with author Mel Watkins and asked him about the film and his lifelong best friend. All right, so we just came out of that movie. You saw the story about your friend Al. And I'm just wondering, when that happened, Mel, did Al tell you the story that day when it happened? What do you remember?
He mentioned it probably a day after or that day. I'm not quite sure. I don't remember. But very soon afterwards. He didn't talk in depth about it. But he did mention it.
Did he say to you, like, oh, my God, you're not going to believe what happened to me the other day? Or was he just sort of like, that's just...
Well, he covered up at first, initially when he told me.
Why did he cover up?
He covered up his feelings about it.
Oh.
He didn't cover up the fact that it happened. Al and I, you have to remember, had talked a lot about... we had started at that point in our lives to talk about race, to talk about things like what happens with, we talked about Richard Wright, for instance, and one of the few black authors that I had read at that point, Black Boy, I believe it was. But we talked about racism in terms of how black was conceived and how screwed up the society was in terms about race and so forth.
Yeah.
So this wasn't a surprise to Al
right.
that this would have happened. But he was still hurt by it, and initially hurt so much that he covered it up in terms of really talking about how much it hurt him.
Okay, do you think, though, that having that happen to Al, right, and then him becoming the first African-American faculty member at Youngstown State, mm-hmm. do you think, like, what did that do for Al? In other words, like, did it say, like, look, I've come full circle here. I've come from the point where they wouldn't even let me in the pool and touch the water to becoming the first full-time African American faculty member. Was it a sense of accomplishment for Howard? What was Al's take on that?
I mean, I think it played into it, but again, no one incident. It was an accumulation of things that did that. Mm. And this was a part of it. And this was obviously a heavy and very dramatic one for Al. So I'm not diminishing it in terms of what it did, mm-hmm. but it's not as if it stood alone. So this was something that was a part of your everyday life.
So at the end of the day, after you've seen this movie and seen that your friend's story is now in a feature film in movie theaters all across the country,
yeah.
and you knew Al very well, you were best friends as kids growing up, what do you think Al's biggest legacy that he's left us with? What's the biggest piece of the biggest gift that he left us?
I think it's his work, his painting. I think his accomplishments as a professor and a teacher certainly are remarkable in themselves, and they are significant achievements. But I think it's his work as an artist he would be most proud of.
What's one thing that, for someone that doesn't know Al Bright, what's the one thing you'd want them to know about Al as his best friend?
The one thing that's difficult. Question to answer. But I think it was his overriding sense of optimism and being positive, that Al always felt that he could do nearly everything that he wanted to do. He also felt that I think he understood something perhaps better than I did when we were younger. I mean, I got to it later on, but I think when we were younger, that Al realized that the impression that you make on other people is very, very important. Al was more of an outgoing, extroverted personality than I.
Mm-hmm.
So Al was very much into, you can change people's minds by the impression you make on them, by the way you present yourself. I got to that later. I was much more introverted and into ideas and so forth. Al was much more mm-hmm. into doing things. And he
certainly left us with some beautiful impressions in his work.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's the thing that he would be proudest of. And I think it's the way it should be, because race is a burden that one has to deal with if you happen to be on the negative side of it in this country. But overcoming that is not something that you walk around being proud of. You're proud of the same thing that any other human being is proud of. That is what you achieve in terms of your life. And what Al achieved in terms of his life, despite racism, is his artwork, is his accomplishments as a teacher and a professor. So it's not showing anybody anything. It's about feeling a certain way about yourself, being proud of who you are, and wanting other people to know who you are, regardless of the social situation in terms of prejudice in this country. That that is not the most important thing. I think African Americans, like any other people, are concerned with achievement. They're concerned with being themselves.
Alrighty, thank you for listening. Until next time, give us a follow on Instagram at @from_Ohio. And if you're so inclined, please leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other Buckeyes find From Ohio.